Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki. We're going to jump right into our show today. You know, it is sadly true and truly sad. What's come to be known as globalism can also be called gobbleism, as it's become a way for those with way too much money and way too much power to gobble up our planetary resources and keep the world's population armed against one another. To keep the system in place, there's a system of impropaganda perpetuated by a media controlled by a few corporate players. In other words, globalization equals gobbleization equals gerbilization, as in G-O-E-B-B-E-L-F, Goebbels, okay? Well, fortunately, there's an awakening, an uprising, as we call it, by those who see a new kind of global engagement that comes from bottom-up awareness instead of top-down imposition. Our guest this week on Wiki Politiki, Jonathan Granoff, is the president of Global Security Institute, is a truly a voice in the bewilderness, who recognizes that our current way of pursuing security, and I put that in quote marks, is both obsolete and obsoletal. Instead of promoting endless growth, that is, extraction of non-renewable resources and preserving peace by preparing for war, we need to encourage the cooperation necessary for sustainable living and development. That's what he says. I know. He is proposing a sane world. He must be crazy. Well, my sense is that Jonathan is calling for a sane asylum where we find and cultivate the sane and sacred center that represents our true human potential. Jonathan Granoff is an attorney, author, and international advocate emphasizing the legal and ethical dimensions of human development and security, with a specific focus on advancing the rule of law to address international security and threats posed by nuclear weapons. He is on numerous governing and advisory boards, including Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, Fortune Forum, Jane Goodall Institute, the NGO Committee on Disarmament, Peace and Security, Parliamentarians for Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament, and Middle Powers Initiative. He's a recipient of the Rutgers University School of Law's Arthur E. Armitage Distinguished Alumni Award, and he was a nominee in 2014 of the Nobel Peace Prize. He writes in a recent piece, quote, "The planet can be understood as one integrated living system. Humanity can be understood as one species in a web of life. We require a new set of ideas in accord with this understanding." Unquote. Well, I totally agree with that. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you so much. A little much on the bio, but one can't expect anything less, except, Stephen, you might get punished for the abuse of language.
Well, hopefully there'll be a number of ways for us to play with words in this period of time we have together. I'm going to begin with a story, classic story. Reporter from the Jerusalem Post many years ago. She hears that a quiet old man has gone every day for 25 years to the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem to pray for peace. Well, one day, somebody points the man out to her, and she walks up to him gently, and she says, "Excuse me, I understand you've been coming to the Wailing Wall every day for 25 years to pray for peace. He says, yes, that's right. And she says, and you haven't missed a day. He goes, yes, that's true. She says, tell me, what's it like to go to the Wailing Wall to pray for peace every day for 25 years? He looks at her and he says, it's like talking to a goddamn wall. Okay, so you have also been working for true global security through peace for at least that long. What has that been like for you, and what gives you the encouragement at this moment?
Solomon was talking to an ant, and he said, what are you doing? He said, the ant said, I'm taking this mountain down. And Solomon said, but time is so short, the mountain is so large, and you're so small. And the ant said, ah, but my beloved rewards my intention.
Uh-huh.
So I don't view, I think if you view the metrics of doing peace work according to operational thinking, then you would have discarded the successes of Socrates, who certainly was, you know, was judged, he was judged by 500 jurors to be a threat to the community and sentenced him to death. Jesus would have certainly been a failure within one night. All 12 of his closest disciples abandoned him. So I don't think I certainly don't look at what I'm doing and use those metrics. And also, it's impossible to tell what would have happened but for the work and advocacy one does to make the world a better place. So it's a matter of integrity of conscience. And if you can live your life with integrity of conscience, that's a success, in my opinion. So how do you know? I mean, because people do terrible things in good conscience. You need some standards to evaluate your own policies in the world. So Gandhi had a very good way of doing it, Mahatma Gandhi. He said, if you're going to advance a policy, just think of how will it affect the most disenfranchised, poorest, powerless person you can imagine. If it's a benefit to that person, it's a good policy. If it's a burden to them, either indirectly or directly, it's a bad policy. Which is pretty much what Jesus says in Matthew. You know, I was hungry, did you feed me? I was naked, did you clothe me? I was in jail, did you visit me? And the disciples said, we never saw you like that. And then he says, what you do to the least amongst you do to me. So I think that's a good way of evaluating public policies that need to be advanced. In terms of private policy, I think the best thing is to one, seek and find the highest love you have within yourself. If you haven't found that, stop and do that. Once you've found that, then see and then get the feeling of what that love is, and then say, in a personal way, not a policy way, in a personal way, is this activity bringing that love into manifestation? And then it's a good thing to follow. So those are my metrics. And I never
I
thought
think
of
that's
it
really,
before that way.
That's really important. Go ahead. I like that. Go ahead. You're going to say something else.
Well, I mean, that's a really good question to pose to oneself, like, what are your standards of success in whatever endeavor you're doing? And in a larger sense, the world at large is facing debates right now about how do we govern ourselves? What are the standards of success? The pandemic challenges our political institutions to step up, because science was telling our political class for years to be prepared for a pandemic, but the political class of all of our nations pretty much ignored it. I mean, it was very much on the margins, the economic allocations to address and prepare for a pandemic. And sort of like we're like trying to build the airplane as it's taking off. We're not really doing a very good job. I mean, 500,000 people in the United States have died. That this is a catastrophe of huge proportions.
Mm-hmm.
And the political actors who would normally be held to account for this are not being held to account. I mean, you know, if you just think of it, I'm in the law, if you're grossly negligent, or if you're grossly negligent, you know that there's a train that's going to hit a school bus, and you know that's going to happen, and you don't stop the train, and the school bus is stuck on the tracks, and you know it's going to hit the train, and you say, well, let's go have a picnic. Well, I mean, that's grossly negligent. And here we had a situation where we had political leaders who knew that this pandemic was going to spread, and yet they were willing not only to ignore it, but to actually say it was a hoax. And yet they're not being held to account. So we're in a real situation where simply trying to tell the truth almost becomes a revolutionary act.
Well, you know, that's certainly true. I was watching a video from almost 50 years ago, from the mid-1970s, or maybe even the early 1970s, from the Club of Rome. And this was an organization, they wrote a book called The Limits of Growth, back in almost 50 years ago now. And they were talking about all of these conditions that we've seen manifest, all of the environmental conditions and all of these things. And fundamentally, they were calling on our institutions, both our governmental institutions and our private institutions, to shift from short-term financial gain to long-term vision that would encompass, you know, what you said earlier. You know, what is it that's going to benefit the least of us? Because if the least of us are cared for, we know everybody else is as well. So it's been almost half a century that we've known about all of these things, and the pandemic is just one manifestation of overpopulation, of reliance on only the short-term benefits of profits, and corporations, which are essentially, if I can say it, sociopathic entities. They've been given free rein to do whatever they want to do, and only be accountable to their shareholders. So, I see that the organization that you're working with, Global Security Institute, was founded more than 20 years ago by Senator Alan Cranston to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and in a certain regard, create a sense of safety that's based on mutual respect and benefit rather than domination. And so here we are. And I appreciate your markers of your sane markers of progress, because really all we can do is look at the impact we've had on the world that small, if not the world at large. How do you see the Global Security Institute over the past 20 or so years where you've been director as having an impact?
We have a couple of programs that have had impacts, and one of them is Parliamentarians for Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament, which mm-hmm. is now about 800 parliamentarians in 80 countries. And parliamentarians are a lot closer to the, to the will of the people than other areas of government usually. So we've created that network, which I believe has been a force for understanding amongst many nations. Very difficult to talk about successes when you're promoting peace, because peace amongst nations is a non-event.
When Al Gore put the idea of efficiency in government and management by objective into play in our government, it's been a boon for the Defense Department, enormous boon, because the Defense Department can say our yearly plan is we're going to produce this many more, say, battleships, right? And then they come back the next year and say, look, we met our metrics by 90%. But how do diplomats predict what they're going to prevent from happening? So that's pretty hard to articulate. But one of the things that we did was we created the Middle Powers Initiative, and we had three major conferences with President Jimmy Carter at the Carter Center, where he shared the center with us gratis because he believed in what we were doing. And it was based on the analysis that that the nations with nuclear weapons were intransigent in extolling their virtues and unwilling to live up to their legal obligations to negotiate elimination of nuclear weapons. And the non-aligned countries of the world were demanding a nuclear weapons convention, a treaty eliminating nuclear weapons now. And so we had each of these conferences were 3 days long. We had the top policymakers and diplomats of the key countries of the world there, most of the key countries. And I would say that we made a contribution to building a bridge-building agenda between these two very, very diverse points of view that would reduce the salience of nuclear weapons in policy, the number of nuclear weapons, and strengthen the verification regime. To a large extent, in the last few years, our nation, under the Donald Trump administration, backed away from that architecture of progress by simply treating treaties, you know, pretty much like real estate negotiations or something informal, and degrading international law I would say un-American way, mm-hmm. walking away from that architecture. Hopefully, I know President Biden. And he believes in the rule of law. He believes in moving toward a nuclear weapons-free world. He believes in global cooperation. So we might see that edifice, you know, revive. I don't know how he's going to be able to revive the trust deficit with the rest of the world, but that has to happen. That has to happen because the footprint of science and technology today not only affects the whole world in ways that are unprecedented, but stretches deep into the future and even, in fact, challenges whether there will be a future. And there's two mythologies that I think are driving this process. In the realm of economics, it's the mythology of perpetual growth. You've mm-hmm. mentioned the limits of growth. It is that the natural world is infinite and that its resources cannot be depleted, and that therefore our quest for more property can be unlimited. And in fact, you measure economic success by the metrics of growth, not by the metrics of providing happiness and well-being to a population. And certainly there's no reference to the natural world as a standard that we have to live by. And in fact, in accounting of our major corporations, the environment is not treated and the cost to the environment is not treated in bookkeeping. It's an externality that's passed on to future generations. We are seeing now the impact on the climate demands a realism in our economic system. Our economic system has to come to grips with the fact that the natural world has its own laws and we can't violate them. We can have Planet B in our minds, but there is no Planet B. You can have Plan A and Plan B, but you can't have Planet B. There's just one system and we have to live with a little humility in it. If the human experiment fails, the ants will do just fine. But if the ants don't live well, we have about 2 months, and then the place becomes garbage. The other myth is prepare for war, receive peace. Prepare for peace, receive war. That's a Roman maxim based on the premise that the more power your country has, the power through military power, peace is achieved. Now, the problem with that is that it's a communicable disease, and if your country pursues that, others will do so as well. And nuclear weapons become the ultimate paradox of that pursuit. The more the weapon is perfected, the less security is obtained. And as long as we pursue modernizing our arsenals, we are stimulating a new arms race, and the net result is less security. So we have to come to grips with the fact that we live as one human community, and trying to bring about security through the threat of annihilating the future is not only irrational, it's truly unsustainable, because eventually, by mistake, design, or madness, the weapons will be used. So the myth of peace through military power and the myth of absolute economic growth are two myths that we need to become realistic and realize our greater interest in pursuing peace is by cooperating and protecting our natural home. 50 to 70% of our oxygen. I'm sorry.
We're going to have to take a very short break right now. We'll be back with Jonathan Granoff, and we'll talk a little bit more about how we can actually do some of these things and turn the ideal into the real deal when we're back on WikiPolitik.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
COVID-19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
If you're feeling increasingly lonely right now, you're not alone. It's totally normal. Even though we may not be able to get together in person, connecting virtually with friends and family still gives you a chance to interact with people and may help raise your spirits. Join a virtual book club, set up group text chats, or online video coffee breaks with coworkers.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Okay, Steve Behrman here. I'm back with our guest, Jonathan Granoff. We're really talking about this vexing situation where we have system of economic growth that really isn't about the growth of happiness, really about the growth of things and increased extraction. And this system seems to be tied in with the military-industrial complex and those forces that keep this continual arming as our way toward peace. These things seem connected. How can we break that pattern?
I think we have a global language of science. Oddly enough, science is a wonderful tool for understanding the natural world. And we're not applying it to our economic system, and that's that. So that tool is available. Well, let's look at this a little bit. Step back a bit. Let's look at it historically. What has happened in the past when political institutions are not able to address existential critical challenges that face human communities? Mm-hmm. I think the deepest parallel would be in the 17th century, when in Europe there was the push for individual moral freedom and economic freedom posed by the Reformation. Sounds like it was created by you, who were protesting the domination of the whole Holy Roman Empire and the feudal system of city-states and feudalism, which dominated the capital markets, and also posed itself to be the intermediary between man and salvation. And so you had Protestants and Catholics arguing over Jesus' love, whose definition was best. And because they were fighting for eternal salvation, they were willing to die and get to heaven fast and send others there before them. So in parts of Europe, a third of the population was decimated in the slaughter, very low-tech slaughter. But there were smart people who sat back and said, you know, this is not going to stop unless we do something about it. And we have two basic mythologies or worldviews, and I didn't mean mythology in a degrading sense. I meant ways of understanding mystery that are just not going to stop. And out of that, in the middle of 1640s, that a bunch of wonks who are not popularly known got together in a place called Westphalia and created the modern state. We went from city states to modern states in that very, in the next decades, the modern state as we understand it emerged. It didn't exist before then. People have to grasp that. It didn't just come out of the blue. It didn't come. We haven't always been in nation states with borders and the concept of sovereignty of the state. But something happened in that same period that was essential for that nation state to emerge. And it was called the printing press, which allowed for people in Lyon to speak the same language as people in Paris, because you didn't have a national grammar until you had the printing press. And out of that, you could develop a national identity. It was very important for the creation of the state. Well, today, if we look at almost every institution, they're global. They're borderless. The cyber world is completely borderless. Commerce is borderless. Capital, the flow of capital is borderless. Art, culture, science, borderless. Communications, borderless. The clothes that you and I are wearing have been, the capital has come from one country, the resources from another, and was probably sewn together in a third country and then shipped around the world. We live in an integrated human community. The institutions through which we pursue security, the identities that have become inextricably connected to security, are provincial. And out of that identity emerges this distorted pursuit of security through excessive military nationalism. And people are, with any sense of reason, are saying, oh my goodness, the needs of the whole human family have to be addressed. And so I'm very hopeful in that regard, because this is the first time in human history where we have this global recognition of our frailty, our mortality. The pandemic has raised the issue of a borderless world right before us. We cannot survive in a vaccine apartheid world. The virus doesn't recognize borders. So we're sort of at a place now in which these ideas are going to be the currency of the future and have to be brought into fruition, or we could be the last generation.
You know, you mentioned the printing press as a really key innovation that allowed for this reorganization. Here, obviously, we have the power of the internet, which is our global web of communication. And one would imagine that this can become the tool for sharing information, good information, more quickly. We haven't come to that point yet, and we seem to have this this tremendous division in this country and also in the world in relation to I'm very curious to get your take on Trumpism. I'm going to ask you that. But my sense is that just as surely as people on the progressive side were greatly fearing authoritarian rule by an oligarch, by one man, authoritarian oligarch, taking us back to feudalism, On the right, you know, the people who supported Trump, many of them, they were concerned about a global authority that was not really in touch with the needs of the people, but was really simply a top-down imposition of world authority. And I'm just wondering how you see this this conflict that apparently is not going to go away playing out or getting resolved in this country, for one thing.
Let's not talk about this. Let's talk about the ideas themselves and the reality of it. I think that the right-wing concern of unaccountable bureaucracies and governance, the sensibility that is correct, and the but their information is not correct. They don't understand the power of the strategic command in the amount of money and resources that's taken away from them with a bureaucracy in the military-industrial complex that actually makes decisions that affect our daily lives. Trump pledged about $1.9 trillion to modernize the nuclear arsenal with no debate, no public debate. That's game-changing money. And that was to feed these extremely powerful elites that operate top-down without very much public debate or accountability. Our military budget in the United States last year was in excess of $7.5 billion. With no debate, it was bipartisan, but Republicans and Democrats brought it into fore. It's half of the military budget of the planet. We're only 4% of the world's population, so it's an extraordinary amount of power in the hands of very, very few people. So their concern for unaccountable power has some merit. So we need to understand the right, left, and find what's good and good and what's wrong in all sides of the equation. Mm-hmm. And let me give an example of how this is going to play out in the near future. We can anticipate, say, within the next decade or two, kits that will be relatively inexpensive that will allow any hospital in the world to swab a newborn's saliva and get its genetic code. And that information could be extremely valuable if collected in one place, analyzed, and utilized for public health, certainly in addressing pandemics and other diseases. That place, that group, will have enormous power, whoever has that information. Mm-hmm. That will provide enormous power to them. And it will also have the potential to provide enormous benefit. Now, we know that when you have unaccountable power, when you have power that's not supervised, analyzed, transparent, and accountable, abuse takes place. And so our system of government in the United States is based on constraining power, that we call it checks and balances. But we've just seen how fragile the checks and balances system is. The Chinese model is based purely on efficiency. What is the most efficient way of providing goods and services to people? They claim they've taken over 300 million people out of poverty in the last two decades. So they will be making the case that this is a good thing to do. But they don't respect the sanctity of the individual. They don't respect the rule of law. They don't respect accountability or any of the fundamental values in human rights. So we're at the verge now where we have to have real serious conversations globally on what are the values that we have, what makes us human. And part of that, of course, will be efficiency, but that's not sufficiency. Oh, Stephen, I'm getting infected by you. So
that's a very good distinction.
Efficiency is not sufficiency. So their concern of if we move toward a world purely based on utilitarian standards of what's efficient in providing goods and services, The trains ran on time under Mussolini's rule. Where a train based on unaccountable assertion of power in a world in which you have artificial intelligence, biometrics, and quantum computing, the ability for a handful of people to manipulate the population globally is very, very real. Their concerns are not frivolous. I'm a strong advocate of the UN system and a strong advocate that on many issues, global cooperation is absolutely imperative. But I also understand that the arrogance of power is not something to be taken lightly.
You know, right here in this country, I see the meta pattern of divide and conquer. Because we are so entrenched in these polarized positions that get reinforced by each side. I get Democrat emails, Republican emails, and they're all basically the same thing. Look at the horrible thing the other guy did, send us $3. So in this polarized system, I know that the majority of humans in this country, it's been estimated about 75% of people would much prefer to be cooperating to solve problems rather than fighting unnecessary battles and wasting tremendous amounts of energy fighting against the worst excesses of the other side. In this next 10 or 20 year period, I figure it's got to be 10 years because, given the crises that we're facing, how do we actually bring people together in conversation so that people begin to have a common understanding and appreciation of how we do work together and what are the checks and balances? And in terms of checks and balances, one of the things that's thwarted checks and balances in our system is the unaccountable power of money that has impacted our political system that was not factored in when the founders wrote the Constitution.
Absolutely. Campaign finance reform is absolutely essential. We have to take pay-to-play out of our electoral system. That goes without saying. But one of the things that we're faced with is the ability of the internet to be used to create false, or intentionally creating false realities for people, and lying, intentionally lying. And how do you address them? What Cambridge Analytica did in the Trump election, I think is criminal. They created false realities for people, and they willingly and intentionally lied about many things. How do you deal with that? I certainly don't see that we should have some, a government board deciding what ideas can be circulated. That would lead to the tyranny very quickly. I think it would be very beneficial if anything that is posted is sourced, so that a person has to defend the point of view that they put forward, instead of using data mining to manipulate using lies. Now that's problematic. That would work in liberal democracies like the United States, but that same process would lead to the death of people in authoritarian and totalitarian regimes like China or Russia or Saudi Arabia or Turkey or Iran. So how are we going to deal with the cyber world and the need for the pursuit of trying to tell the truth rather than manipulating people? That's a problem I don't have a simple solution for, but it's going to take a lot of really bright minds to have that conversation, to come up with solutions for it, because it's happening in real time. And if you add biometrics and quantum computing to data mining and the ability to manipulate people in ways that they don't even know that they're being manipulated, that's going to put a lot of power in the hands of a few people. And that's right around the corner. I mean, that's basically what Cambridge Analytica did in the 2016 election. And people crave community, and now they're living in virtual communities. Not actual communities of real caring. They're living in communities through the internet, which doesn't really satisfy the heart. It's an illusion.
Well, you make a really good point there in that in these virtual communities, people are gathered not around, you know, here we are, we're sitting around eating food together, but we're focused in on a particular ideological meme or idea. And so, you know, during the lockdown, you know, many people use that time to go deep, some down the proverbial rabbit hole, to go deep and learn a lot of stuff that might not actually be accurate, and then find themselves in community around that. And perhaps that's one of the things that sparked the January 6th, quote-unquote, insurrection.
Absolutely. We know that that's the case. And they're not at really gathering around ideas. They're gathering around a sense of community and identity. I mean, you and I, we're talking about identity. Our reference point is human survival and thriving.
Yeah.
But people don't give up their lives and well-being over survival. They give up their lives over identity, over religious identity and national identity, and stories that will lead them to believe they will have dealt connected to something that will go beyond their death, immortality. That's the core insecurity. And the only cure for that core insecurity, which is the fear of death, is before time's up, finding the luminosity of the soul within oneself. And there's a perennial path to doing that, which is moving from love of self that's separate to selfless love. And in every culture, in every time, there are wise people who explain ways of pursuing lives of virtue and discovering the infinite within one's own being. And it's always about compassion, love, and integrity. So we have a culture that promotes competitive isolation, domination of others, and divisiveness, and is not providing a story for people that actually helps them obtain the security that allows for community to grow. And people like yourself, Steve, you help build a community of caring people and give people a sense of the value of being empowered to act on their highest, most beautiful virtues that are inherent in being human. The people I know I'm talking to are people who actually are people who care about the heart as a center of their lives.
You know, this is interesting because you mentioned science earlier, and guess what? Science is confirming what the spiritual teachers have been saying for millennia, that cooperation is an evolutionary practice. And, you know, my work with Bruce Lipton over the years has been, you know, in spontaneous evolution, is recognizing that the next phase of human evolution is, if we get there, is seeing that we're all cells in the same body, and that so much of what we've been talking about as what isn't working in the world is a form of autoimmune disease where healthy human beings are thwarting other healthy human beings, and the vast majority of our resources is being used for to defend against other people in inappropriate ways. You talked about a story. How do we create? And again, this is a, you know, for a much longer conversation, but let's begin the conversation. What are the keys to creating this new narrative that feels like something that's being realized from the bottom up rather than being imposed from the top down?
Well, that's, I would call that the pursuit of human security based on the understanding the natural world through the use of science and on the application of the perennial virtues and values inherent in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the inherent dignity of the individual that makes us human, and those two sort of prongs on a tuning fork should be the basis of our policies. And you can't separate them. If it's going to be human security, it has to recognize our humanity. And if it's going to be realistic, it has to utilize the best tools that we have to understand the natural world. So those, that I would say that's the place where the conversation has to take place. We have to go from a military model of security to a human security model of security. But
you know, there
but
are many,
in the United States, yeah. in the United States, we are largely still in the driver's seat, driving the arms race on the planet. And I think I would presume most of this audience is familiar with acupuncture. In an acupuncture, you don't just stick a bunch of needles, you know, in a human body. There's nodes in which, if you put the needle, it releases an enormous amount of energy for healing, because the concept is, if you conceive of the body as having like a plumbing system of energy, where energy is flowing, that there's blockages. I see nuclear weapons as the ultimate as an ultimate acupuncture point for social change, in which morality, law, reason, and survival all come together. So pursuing the abolition of nuclear weapons means addressing the very core paradigm of pursuing security by threatening annihilation of oneself as well. Because if a very small percentage of the weapons are used, everybody goes up. You know, we're really still, during the Cold War, we were like two characters in the basement, knee-deep in gasoline, holding matches, you know, mm-hmm. and threatening each other. We now have nine nuclear weapon states with nuclear weapons, and any one of them could actually end the human civilization by releasing the bombs. Well, North Korea is not large enough, but all the others are, and throwing sufficient amount of millions of tons of soot into the stratosphere and ending sufficiency of agriculture. So, you know, we've sort of come to the end of the road of pursuing our mythologies based on limited identities, and come back to the reality that we are all part of one human family, and that that we're born with the capacity of knowing the mystery of life and loving one another, and pursuing that as an actual serious goal.
This is so true. You know, this is the evolution that we're talking about. You know, my joke is, Jesus believed in evolution, otherwise he would have said, now don't do a thing till I get back. So basically, this evolution that we're talking about is a spiritual and psychological evolution that will lead to the political and economic evolution that will allow us to trust ourselves enough to govern ourselves and to begin to engage in a way that we haven't done. So I so appreciate your work and your intention, because it brings that that transcendent dimension. If you want to transform, if you want to get away from these transactional this versus that and transform that, you actually have to get to transcend so that you recognize what you were just talking about, the bigger picture of who we are.
But you don't have to put them in that order, because the institutions that we create are the expression of whatever state we're in, and then it reinforces that state. So it's a dynamic that has to take place at every level. There's no higher level for truth.
I agree. Thank you, Jonathan Granath, for helping us shift from nuclear power to new clear power. Thanks so much for being my guest on WikiPolitiki. Bless you, and we'll catch you on the fun way.